From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ukraine crisis. Mali remains in need of humanitarian assistance. Could CAR violence lead to partition? Plus a deadly fire along Chile's central coast. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Russia came under heavy criticism from world powers at an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council late Sunday as deadly clashes flared between pro-Russian separatists and pro-government supporters in eastern Ukraine. Russia, which called that meeting, rejects charges that they're instigating unrest in eastern Ukraine. Russian UN Ambassador Vitaly Churkin called on the council to ask Kiev to, in his words, stop the use of force against eastern Ukrainian people, who are largely ethnic Russians. The UN meeting came ahead of a deadline for the pro-Russian militias in Ukraine to lay down their arms. And now for the latest on the situation in eastern Ukraine, we turn to Henry Ridgewell, who reports now from one of the pro-Russian protest sites in the city of Donetsk.
A Ukrainian soldier lies on the ground with a gunshot wound to the chest outside the eastern city of Slovyansk Sunday. He was among the first casualties in what many fear could be an imminent conflict. A witness says a group of gunmen opened fire on the soldiers as they prepared for an assault on pro-Russian protesters who have taken over state buildings in the city. Authorities say one member of the security forces died. Russian media report at least one protester was also killed. Pro-Russian groups are reinforcing their positions ahead of an expected assault. At least two more state buildings were stormed Sunday in Mariupol and Yenikeyevo. Ukraine's acting president, Alexander Turchinov, accused Russia of instigating the uprisings.
Rada nacionalnoi bezpeki ta obrony.
In a live televised address to the nation Sunday, Mr. Turchinov said the National Security and Defense Council made a decision to start a full-scale anti-terrorist operation employing the armed forces of Ukraine. He added, "We will not allow Russia to repeat the Crimean scenario in the eastern regions of Ukraine." The president gave protesters until 8 a.m. local time Monday to disarm or face an assault by the army. In Donetsk, ground zero of the pro-Russian protests that erupted a week ago, organizers tried to stir the crowd with Soviet-era military music. But there was palpable fear among the demonstrators. This man, wearing a mask and wielding a metal rod, refused to give his name. "Of course I'm concerned," he said. "It's moving closer. The powers that think we shouldn't exist are getting closer." Many families turned out in support of the protesters Sunday. Among them was Olga. She said, "Of course we are in fear, and that's why we are staying here, because those are the lives of our boys in that building. Do we look like terrorists? We don't have masks and we don't have weapons. Do I look like a terrorist?" Kiev's ultimatum has brought the prospect of conflict another step closer. The protesters now must decide how far they are prepared to take the fight. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Donetsk.
And the United States is saying that Russia appears to be employing the same tactics in eastern Ukraine that were used to seize and annex Crimea. VOA's Michael Bowman reporting now that the Obama administration says it stands ready to impose new sanctions against Moscow if Ukraine's sovereignty is violated once again.
Gun battles between Ukrainian special forces and pro-Russian militias constitute another escalation of conflict in eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russian residents are agitating for autonomy from Kiev. Russian officials insist they have no territorial designs on eastern Ukraine. But the Obama administration sees the hidden hand of Moscow behind current developments. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power appeared on ABC's This Week television program.
"It has all the telltale signs of what we saw in Crimea. It's professional, it's coordinated, there's nothing grassroots seeming about it."
Even before the current escalation of tensions in eastern Ukraine, some U.S. lawmakers urged the United States and Europe to take a stronger stand against Russian territorial expansion. Speaking on CBS's Face the Nation program, Republican Senator John McCain said President Vladimir Putin has yet to pay a significant price for Russia's actions.
The question is now, what do we do and what does he do? It's obvious that he is encouraged by the fact that we sanctioned a few people and suspended him. They didn't even throw him out of the G8. Obviously, with all his troops massed there, he is keeping those options open.
Ambassador Power insists Russia has paid a price for its annexation of Crimea and will pay a bigger one if the crisis deepens.
The Russian stock market has depreciated by 20%. Investors are fleeing, and that's just on the basis of the sanctions that we put in place up to this point. The president has made clear that depending on Russian behavior, sectoral sanctions against energy, banking, mining could be on the table.
Asked if she believes Russian President Vladimir Putin wants control of eastern Ukraine, Power said Moscow's actions give credence to that conclusion, despite Russia's insistence to the contrary. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Syrian government forces launched air raids over rebel-held areas. It was around the capital, Damascus, and districts of Aleppo, with casualties reported. Edward Uranian reporting now from Cairo.
Amateur video showed government warplanes overflying rebel-held suburbs of Damascus amid reports of bombing raids Sunday on the suburbs of Douma and Deraya. Witnesses also reported air raids and numerous casualties in and around Aleppo, the country's largest city. Shelling against rebel-held districts of Aleppo, along with air raids Sunday, killed more than two dozen people, according to Arab TV channels. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Suicide car bomber in northern Iraq has killed at least seven people. That bomber drove his explosive-laden vehicle into a security checkpoint happening northwest of the city of Kirkuk. Officials say at least 11 people were wounded in the attack on Sunday, and no one has claimed responsibility. Sunday marked the beginning of what's known as Holy Week for many Christians. It was Palm Sunday, and Robert Berger attended festivities in Jerusalem.
Bells called the faithful to Palm Sunday prayers at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem's Old City, the traditional site of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. Palm Sunday marks the beginning of Easter Holy Week and Jesus' entry into Jerusalem on a donkey more than 2,000 years ago. Inside the church, worshipers waving palm and olive branches held a festive Palm Sunday procession around the ancient stone tomb revered by believers as the place where Jesus rose from the dead. They marched through a fragrant cloud of incense, chanting Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Pilgrims came from around the world, including Miriam Akin of Nigeria.
Oh, I feel great. I feel awesome. I feel elated. And I give all the glory to God for bringing us to this awesome place.
Jane Reynolds of the U.S. state of Georgia said Palm Sunday in Jerusalem brings the Bible to life.
This is where Jesus actually went down that hill into the city. It just is amazing to me to think I'm in the same spot. And to think that it really happened and that it's not just black and white on the pages.
Jerusalem will host a flood of pilgrims this week as Easter week coincides with the Jewish feast of Passover, which begins at sundown on Monday. Robert Berger for VOA News in Jerusalem's Old City.
Voters in Guinea-Bissau stood in long lines on Sunday to pick a new president and parliament. There were 13 presidential candidates with no clear front runner. It has been almost 2 years since they tried to hold an election. In April of 2012, a military coup disrupted that presidential poll as it headed to a runoff. Two prominent political figures who were headed to the presidential runoff back in 2012 did not run this time around. Both men were controversial when it came to the country's tumultuous political-military relations. Former President Kumba Yala died earlier this month. He had already resigned from his party and backed an independent in this particular race. Former Prime Minister Carlos Gomes Jr. had been expected to win the 2012 runoff, but was instead forced into exile after the coup. He remains in Portugal. Guinea-Bissau analyst Elisabetta Azevedo Harmon of the London-based think tank Chatham House.
It's really interesting that you come up for this election with the two main parties for the first time, with a different generation leading for the election. That makes the parties weaker. Yes, it's true that they don't have, you know, the charisma of previous candidates and that are well known by the population, but maybe it's a good sign for the need to have the short-term balance between the militaries and the politics.
Political analysts say they expect the Guinea-Bissau vote this time around to go to a second round, 15 parties running for the parliamentary seats. UN humanitarian coordinator for Mali says the country is in a deepening state of humanitarian crisis, with an additional 400,000 people expected to face food insecurity by the month of June. Humanitarian assistance is drastically underfunded there, and the return of the refugees who fled the conflict in 2012 and 2013 is making things worse. Jennifer Lazuda reporting now from VOA's West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
The United Nations says that 1.4 million people in Mali are currently in need of food assistance. This is up from 812,000 people in December 2013 and could rise to 1.9 million by June as the lean season sets in. Late and erratic rains last year, combined with ongoing conflict in the north of the country, meant poor crop harvest throughout much of the country. This has meant that food stocks of many families are just not there. David Gressley is the UN humanitarian coordinator for Mali.
Mali continues to face very important humanitarian challenges in 2014. People have just gone through a very, very difficult period in Mali, and particularly in the north, with the conflict, with the occupation. People are even more vulnerable than normal because of all of this. We're seeing in particular on the food side continued food insecurity, so we're quite concerned.
Gressley said an estimated 500,000 children under the age of 5 in Mali will suffer from moderate to severe malnutrition this year, and 136,000 children will be severely malnourished. He said Mali could see a spike in its child mortality rate if these cases are left untreated. He said there is also concern among humanitarian workers that the food security situation could further deteriorate as those displaced by the conflict return home.
We're seeing increasing numbers of refugees coming home. Half the IDPs have come home. Puts an additional burden on local communities as the numbers increase. It will take a while before those who are coming home can also contribute to local production. The agriculture campaign is just now starting, so they can start, but that we won't see any output from that until at the end of the year.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, says that nearly 200,000 internally displaced people, or IDPs, and refugees who fled to neighboring Niger, Mauritania, and Burkina Faso returned to the north between December and March. Gressley said there could be an acceleration of that return in coming months, particularly if progress is made with ongoing peace discussions. To help ease the burden of food insecurity in the country, Mali's government pledged to contribute 34,000 tons of cereal to food aid efforts this year. Gressley said that this is quite a significant contribution, but is not enough. OCHA reports that $568 million is needed to provide humanitarian assistance, including food aid, in Mali in 2014. As of the end of March, donors had only funded around 10%, or $56 million, of this amount. Gressley said that this lack of funding is quite worrying.
It's unfortunate, but there are many crises around the world right now, in South Sudan, Central African Republic, Syria, etc., that seem to be drawing the resources that are really needed also in places like Mali. And the problem I see with that, not only the humanitarian impact, if you look at the overall needs of Mali in terms of trying to stabilize after the conflict of 2012, insufficient humanitarian assistance is actually a destabilizing impact, has a destabilizing impact as well.
Grassley said many organizations, including the World Food Program, have begun rationing their already limited resources. They hope to buy some time until more funding comes in. He said the UN is now trying to raise additional money by advising donors that there is still a significant and pressing need for humanitarian assistance in Mali. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
UN Refugee Agency reporting that thousands of refugees fleeing the Central African Republic are arriving in Cameroon in horrific condition. Two senior officials who have just visited the region say the refugees report that anti-Balaka militiamen were trying to prevent civilians from leaving the CAR and are attacking them along the way. Lisa Schlein reporting now from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
So what we see is, you can see the other side there. It's not too far. And you see refugees walking over. This day, over 1,000 actually came over.
Paul Spiegel, a medical officer and senior manager for the UN Refugee Agency, describes a video taken at a border crossing between Central African Republic and Cameroon. He is watching refugees traverse a shallow river from the CAR into Biti in Cameroon.
Look, it looks as if their legs, their knees are actually quite swollen, but they're not. It's that you have severe malnutrition, not just in children, which is more the norm, but in adults. And so they've lost so much body mass. These people had come over, they've been walking for up to 3 months, many from Bangui. And as Melissa mentioned in the note, they've been hiding out in the evenings. They've been eating mostly leaves, very poor water.
Spiegel says many of the refugees arrived with wounds from machetes or gunshots. He says the refugees were forced to take lengthy detours to reach this remote border post because anti-Balaka militias block main roads. This, he says, explains the extremely poor condition in which they arrive. Liz Ahua, the UNHCR refugee coordinator for the CAR, and her colleagues got a close-up view of the refugee situation in the region. She spoke with people who are displaced within CAR, with refugees in Chad and Cameroon, and with Chadians who have fled home after many years in exile. She found these people deeply traumatized and broken in spirit.
Whether they be in exile or in their own country, these are people who basically have been caught in a situation that is akin to that of a web of vipers, and they can't get themselves out of it. We need to help the population of Central Africa because they are in this descent into chaos and descent into hell.
The number of refugees fleeing into Cameroon grows. The Biti transit camp, which is meant to provide only temporary accommodation, now holds 15,000 refugees. The UNHCR says it is looking for other sites to build more permanent camps. It also is encouraging refugees to become integrated into the surrounding communities. Since the beginning of the year, more than 69,000 refugees from the CAR have fled to Cameroon. The ongoing crisis in the CAR has displaced about 1 million people since the end of 2012. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And the United Nations is saying that 19,000 Muslims in the Central African Republic remain in imminent danger and should be relocated to safer towns farther north or outside the country. But it is a complex issue, as tens of thousands of them have already fled their homes in the capital and the western half of the country following attacks. Some local authorities worry that further evacuations could deepen divisions and reinforce calls for a partition of the country. VOA's And Look has a report from the CAR capital.
The CAR is a country divided. Muslims are separated from Christians. Some talk of eventual reconciliation, others divorce.
That's what I want. If we separate the country, everyone can be at peace.
Bangui's PK-12 neighborhood. 2,000 Muslims are stuck along this small stretch of road. They can't risk going out. Trouble still makes its way in almost daily.
destroyed through that one thing coming down here.
It was a grenade lobbed by anti-Balaka militia just 2 days ago. 5 people were wounded. UN agencies are preparing to relocate the Muslims of PK-12 further north to towns that have agreed to accept them. Across town in PK-5, these trucks have been packed for weeks.
Even without a military escort, people say they will go. Bria, Bambari, Birao. Everyone is going there. We've had it here.
There are about 10,000 Muslims left in this neighborhood, confined to a 1 kilometer radius since December.
We're in an open-air prison. We are held hostage. We want to go north where we'll be free.
The government has asked the Muslims of PK-5 to stay. The Minister of Communication and Reconciliation came to Friday prayers at the Central Mosque. January and February saw much of the country's Muslim minority flee attacks in the south and the west. Militia were seeking revenge for abuses under the mostly Muslim Seleka rebels. Some Muslims went to Cameroon and Chad, others to towns in the north and the east, areas still under rebel control. The mass exodus saved lives. The government opposes more evacuations, but acknowledges it can't protect Muslims. International troops are overwhelmed and under-resourced. Some question whether they could fend off a separatist attempt by armed groups in the northeast. Presidential spokesman and political advisor Clement Anissé Guillaume Massogo says partition is a dangerous prospect.
Je ne vous cache pas que nous, au niveau de la présidence de la République, nous avons quand même le sentiment que...
We feel there are Islamist extremist groups who are trying to seize upon this situation to further complicate this crisis.
He says the president's position is clear. The country is indivisible. Many of the Muslims packing their bags in Bangui agree. They say they want to reconcile, that they will return when it is safe. But even so, calls for partition are there amid the pleas for rescue. Anne Luck, VOA News, Bangui.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Chilean officials are saying a huge fire has killed at least 16 people and destroyed 500 homes. Happened in the port city of Valparaiso. Thousands of people have been evacuated, including more than 200 female inmates at a prison. The fire began on Saturday in a forested area above ramshackle housing in one of the city's main hilltops. Firefighters are struggling to bring the blaze under control as Pacific Coast winds are fanning the flames. Chile's president, Michelle Bachelet, has declared a state of emergency there, placing armed forces on the city's streets to maintain order and to prevent looting. And she said that in some places the fire had started again, so they are working on protecting the people and working toward already reconstruction. Valparaiso is a UNESCO World Heritage Site 120 kilometers northwest of Chile's capital, Santiago. And some quick sports news. American golfer Bubba Watson has won the Masters Tournament for the second time in 3 years. The Masters Golf Tournament, first major event of the year for professional golfers. Watson shot a final round 3 under par 69 on Sunday. He was ahead of Jordan Spieth, also from the United States, Sweden's Jonas Blitzk, and Spain's Miguel Angel Jimenez. Watts goes home with a $162 million first place prize. I'm sure I'm the only one who's ever called him Watts. I think it's Watson. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in today to the Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. A reminder, the latest world news is coming your way shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair El-Tayeb, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On April 14th in the year 70 AD, Roman forces under the future emperor Titus surrounded the Jewish capital, Jerusalem. Titus later sacked the city, killing many of its residents and scattering Jewish survivors among the nations. On this day in 1759, German composer George Frederick Handel died. Handel, who spent most of his adult life in London, is most famous for his oratorio, Messiah. In 1775, inspired by Quaker activists, the first American anti-slavery organization was formed in Philadelphia. In 1828, Noah Webster copyrighted the first edition of his famous dictionary. It took him 26 years to complete. In 1865, while attending a performance of the comedy Our American Cousin, President Abraham Lincoln was shot at Ford's Theater in Washington. He died the next day. It was the first presidential assassination in U.S. history. In 1906, the Azusa Street Revival opened in Los Angeles, launching the worldwide religious movement known as Pentecostalism. In 1927, the first Volvo car premiered in Gothenburg, Sweden. In 1935, this was Black Sunday, as one of the strongest in a series of dust storms swept across parts of New Mexico, Texas, Colorado, Oklahoma, and Kansas. The dirt and dust built up by drought and soil erosion was driven by high prairie winds. On this day in 2002, the late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez returned to office after initially being ousted in an unsuccessful military coup. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly supports the Tunisian people and their progress toward a future of economic prosperity and democratic government. Since the January 2011 revolution, the United States has committed more than $400 million to support Tunisia's transition, focusing on technical and financial assistance to Tunisia's economy and private sector, support for security in the country and along its borders, and support for its civil society and democratic practices. In an effort to support private sector-led growth in Tunisia, the U.S. has declared its intent to provide another sovereign loan guarantee to Tunisia, enabling the government to raise approximately $500 million from international capital markets at favorable rates. As a means to promote trade and investment in Tunisia, the Bilateral Trade and Investment Framework Agreement Council will address at its next meeting in June issues of market access, entrepreneurship, information and communication technology sectors, and intellectual property. In 2012, the U.S. launched the Thomas Jefferson Scholarship Program. The $10 million initiative sends Tunisian undergraduate students for one academic year of undergraduate studies at U.S. universities and community colleges. The U.S. Congress recently approved an additional $10 million for the program, increasing the total number of students to 400. In an effort to promote democratic governance, the U.S. is providing nearly $50 million to strengthen participatory and inclusive political processes, build the capacity of civil society to stay connected to citizens through ongoing civic education, and promote freedom of expression. The U.S. will provide more than $6 million in additional elections assistance for the planned 2014 elections. The United States has provided more than $100 million since 2011 to help professionalize and improve the capabilities of the Tunisian armed services, and $30 million to help professionalize and improve the capabilities of Tunisian law enforcement and justice sectors. In addition, the U.S. has provided nearly $6 million in training for law enforcement agencies in 2012 and 2013 to combat international terrorists and terrorist organizations. These many initiatives demonstrate the depth and breadth of the partnership and friendship between the United States and Tunisia, as well as the shared commitment to supporting Tunisia's historic democratic transition and its economic growth and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.